Welcome back to the Baseball America College Baseball Podcast. For the first time, it's no longer me and Peter Flaherty. I'm joined by Baseball America draft writer Carlos Collazo. Carlos, I'm glad you were able to join me. I feel like we're going to be able to have a relevant conversation about just how things are going to get going in the college season, just with your expertise on the draft side. So thank you for joining us. How are you? And welcome to the College Pod.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy to be here. Sorry to the listeners who are having to downgrade from Peter to me. But no, I'm excited to talk some college baseball. It's early January. Jacob has been incredibly busy trying to get our college preview together. So that's been kind of cool to just watch happen from afar. And I'm itching to actually get out there and watch some college baseball. It feels like every year around this time, people kind of go a little bit stir crazy. I know maybe you are probably even more in that seat after doing ABCA and doing all the content you're doing. But yeah, happy to be here and talk college baseball.
Yeah, for those of you who are just joining us for the first time or maybe new to the college baseball scene, the lead up to the college baseball season is kind of a sequenced matter of events. Every single year, the American Baseball Coaches Association convention happens in the first week of January somewhere in the country. This year was in Columbus, Ohio. I was there to talk with a whole bunch of Division I coaches and scouts and program administrators. And then it's really kind of a sprint to opening day. February 13th this year is the first day of the Division I college baseball season. If you haven't seen it at baseballamerica.com, you can go do that. We have a list of start dates for other divisions. January 30th, I believe, is our soonest college baseball start date for some of the lower level divisions. But the big one is, of course, Division I opening day. And in order to prep for that, I wanted to talk first about some of the things that we heard at ABCA, because this year, a non-rules year, college baseball changes rules every other year. The conversation was more structural for the sport. This is kind of in a state of change across the entirety of the college sports landscape, just with NIL and how that's impacted things. Right now in college baseball, the biggest change has been the implementation of the Division I Oversight Committee. And basically what that is a group of people, some members voting, which means that they're going to be able to pick who ends up in the Division I tournament, and some non-voting members, these are people who are going to be more involved in the structural changes throughout the sport, is now kind of at the top of college baseball. They're running the show for the first time ever. And we learned a lot about some of the ways that that group is going to impact college baseball in the immediate future. And the biggest takeaway from this year's ABCA convention was that the Division I committee will be making adjustments to how umpires are evaluated. The NCAA signed an agreement with TrackMan that will allow them to send umpires detailed analytical evaluations of their strike zones. And it will allow them also to make better judgments on which umpires get to do the postseason. That'll determine regional assignments. How umpires perform in regionals will determine super regional assignments for the first time ever. Previously, that was a preset thing. And then that will determine Omaha as well. Season performance, super regionals, and regionals all tracked now by data. And so to me, that's a great change for the sport. Kind of feels like an overdue one. My question to you to start is, what was your reaction when you heard about that? And how might this impact the way that we watch the game and maybe perceive draft prospects?
Yeah, my first reaction was that all of it just made sense. And I think, like you mentioned, it's a positive change to the game. I mean, no one wants to be in a key situation in the postseason, in a tournament late in the year, where you feel like you're being put in a position to lose a game because of bad officiating. I think it only makes sense to try and so prior to this change, there, correct me if I'm wrong, Jacob, but there was like a preset list of people who are going to be doing postseason officiating. And the way it's going to work now is umpires will be ranked and reviewed based on this TrackMan feedback, and they're trying to get the best officials into the postseason. I mean, that makes sense. We want the best teams in the postseason. We'd like to have the games be officiated as cleanly and as accurately as possible. It feels like you would have to kind of bend over backwards to find a reason to not like this adjustment. Even if you're someone who's like, oh, I really don't want a robot strike zone, well, this is just a really good way, in my opinion, for umpires themselves to have a quicker feedback loop. Like, okay, if you're consistently missing calls in X area, that should be something that you want to know about as an umpire, regardless of where you're getting that feedback. We have the technology now to hopefully drive more consistent zones across the board. So you're not in a situation where maybe one conference has a group of umpires that consistently calls X strike zone and then another conference Y, or different geographic zones. All of this is very granular and nitpicky. And ultimately, like, if you're watching, I probably don't think you're going to notice much of a difference. But I think it's a good change to the sport.
I think the hope is that people will notice a difference, because this is, at the end of the day, something that the NCAA hopes will be instructive for its umpires, which is something that you just hit on that I think is important. The person who's heading up the umpiring committee is Jeff Gosney, a longtime NCAA official. He's called super regionals and regionals, was in it for 10 years. He called major league games from 2014 to 2015 as a replacement umpire. So this is somebody who has track record in the industry. And one of the things that he said that stood out to me was that there really wasn't that feedback loop within the umpiring structure going into this year. And when he was appointed into the role, it was a lot of subjectivity. And one thing that he said that I found to be almost perplexing was that there was a large gap between how college baseball umpires were evaluated and were able to kind of self-reflect on their own performances versus how college football and basketball referees were able to do so. He said that basketball and football refs would go at post game, and you can go and see, these were the bad calls that you made. There were video reviews that were happening, and they would study their own performances, similar to how you would imagine a pitcher would go and review his own performance after an outing. And the exact quote from him was that college baseball umpires were going back into the locker room and having some popcorn and a cold one and moving on to the next day. And it's like, the product is increasing at such a rapid rate in college baseball. And I think that the public appreciation for the competitiveness of the postseason has gone up so much in recent years that this was almost a change that had to happen in order to keep the playing field as, you know, equitable and, you know, advanced as it possibly could be. Because to your point, the technology existed long ago to be able to do this.
Yeah, no, that's funny to think about. And it does seem like, whether this is just anecdotal or actually like just a baseball thing, umpires at the college level have always seemed a little bit less less willing to like look at the reviews and think back if they made, like, it's almost like the game's over, why are we worried about this now? I made the call, let's move on to the next one. But it's a nice change. And I would say, I think I view umpires as I view catchers. When they're doing a really good job, you almost don't notice them behind the plate. And hopefully that will be the case more frequently with college baseball. If you're not noticing the umpire, typically that's a good thing. If you're noticing the officials a lot in any sport, either it's a really sloppy game being played in sports that have penalties, or there's just a lot of missed calls. So hopefully you're not noticing the umpire in the best way for that. I'm curious if you think this will lead to any sort of adjustment on the field by the players. If you think the zone was either improperly called frequently enough that there will be a material change in either certain archetypes of pitchers or certain like approaches at the plate from the hitting perspective, or maybe even if this will hurt the value of catchers in some capacity. I know that's always the rage at the major league level. If you're going to a full auto zone, will that remove like the benefits you get from your best receivers and pitch framers? But I tend to think it'll be like marginal for all of these players. But I'm curious if you have a different thought on that.
No, I agree. And I would say this, you know, to the critic who hears this and goes, well, here we go towards the robot umpires in college as well. That's not really what's happening here. This is more just a tool that's going to be provided to umpires for them to get better, but it doesn't have an in-game impact, at least directly, because there is no in-game feedback. You make a wrong call, that call is not getting changed in the game. There is no ABS challenge system, which is important. I think that we may notice a change at the bottom and top ends of college baseball umpiring. Like if you have an umpire who's doing a lot of low and mid-major games and his strike zone is inconsistent, that umpire will now be aware of just how inconsistent they are. Like one of the examples that Gosney gave that I really liked was a lot of calls in college are missed at the knees. The low strike is a problem, and it has been for years. This to me is a way for umpires who struggle with that to really adjust aggressively and quickly, because they're going to be able to visualize exactly where they're missing, and you can probably make an adjustment from that point forward. Is it going to impact the middle ground umpire who isn't missing a lot of calls frequently and is generally consistent? Probably not. And I don't think it's going to change guys to call a different game than they had, especially if they are in that reasonably consistent category, even if it doesn't agree with the robotic umpire in the strike zone. I think that guys will still kind of call their game, but I think that this will help iron things out and create a more consistent strike zone across the levels, like really in the low and mid majors. They benefit massively from this. And then the other area is I think we're going to see better umpiring in the postseason. One problem that I've had with the College World Series over the last several years is there's been a lot of questionable ball and strike calling umpires at the highest level of the game. There were a lot of complaints from coaches like, let's go get major league umpires to call the College World Series because it's the finals. It's for the national championship. It's where it matters most. And allowing ball strike calls to impact that was really viewed as a negative by coaches and obviously fans. This to me probably helps at that level because you're talking about the best and brightest and you know, most open and willing umpires who are going to take this feedback and do something positive with it.
Did you get a sense in your reporting for this or just your general conversations on the quality of the TrackMan units around the game, the consistency and the calibration of those units, like where maybe that'll be less effective for umpires? Because I do know, like, one of the things when we're just evaluating players from a draft perspective is there's a lot more variance in like how confident we can be on the TrackMan data for specific skill metrics, because like just some of the systems are maybe not calibrated as properly as you'd like to see. There's still a number of colleges that don't even use TrackMan. So like, what's your sense on like the coverage of the sport at this stage?
Well, I'll say this as far as the, you know, the reliability of TrackMan across college baseball, the hardest hit technically ball in all of college baseball last year was a 129 mile per hour chopper to second base.
Yeah.
Obviously that ball was
going to take the under on that one.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I think that, and there's a whole other conversation about exit velocities to be had.
Right.
But one area that, and this wasn't discussed, you know, during the main stage talk about it, but it was kind of a buzzy conversation after the fact among coaches at ABCA, was that if there's one area of reasonable consistency on TrackMan, it is the strike zone. Like maybe the velocities aren't calibrated as nicely, but generally speaking, and it's not perfect, there is a pretty good sense of strike zone, and the calibration for that is at least decent. Yep. And I think it's decent enough that with the NCAA becoming involved in the implementation of TrackMan, that we'll get enough good data that it's going to be a positive for the umpiring process. Again, I will reiterate, do I think it's going to be perfect? No, because in a lot of cases, especially at the low major level, you're talking about, you know, a college junior or sophomore who's a huge baseball fan and getting involved in the program for the first time, being largely in charge of running that system, and there are flaws that come with that. But I also think that there are a lot of people who do a good job. And I also think that, you know, the strike zone is probably the lowest hanging fruit in order to be able to calibrate. The question I would ask you is, does this have an impact on the draft prospect? Like, are we going to look at pitchers, and is there a, and it probably marginal, but is there a way that we're going to be able to perceive somebody strike throwing differently if there is a dramatic change, or even one that's slightly tangible in how umpires are calling games and whether guys are getting better, more quality strikes on the fringes? Does this help the player at all?
Potentially. My like immediate gut feel reaction to this is that like you're still kind of trying to stack up with all your peers, and you were all under a similar system previously that is just now going to get better, you would think, across the board. And so like the best strike throwers under the previous system, they would have still been victim to the same bad ball strike calls that the worst strike throwers in the game had, or the marginally worst strike throwers. So like I would tend to think that like it would be very unusual or odd for one player in particular, one specific type of player, to be more negatively impacted with their like performance data that maybe won't happen now. So I'd probably think that like, no, you're not going to notice a huge significant difference. Maybe you could say like some of the hitters who actually have really impressive batting eyes, if they were consistently getting low, those kind of at the knees calls you're talking about that aren't strikes but are called strikes, or if there is a consistent issue with the zone that is kind of, you see it across the board for college umpires for whatever reason, maybe there's some like really savvy hitters who are maybe being put in a worse position because they're taking balls they know are balls, and now maybe they'll be put in better positions, better count positions, to both improve like their walk rates, but also just get themselves into counts where they can do more damage offensively. So maybe some of those hitters that really understand the zone and maybe haven't gotten the benefits from that. But I tend to think that like those guys were already standing out for their approach and their zone awareness. So it's not like it's a skill that was completely absent from the game because of some inconsistent umpiring. So I tend to think it'll be just very marginal.
I will say this. I think that the timing of this is ripe from a developmental standpoint and where the game is going as it relates to college baseball. I think that the widespread expectation, and it's not a guarantee, but the expectation is that the draft will shrink in after this 2027 CBA renegotiation. We're going to see more good players getting to college if that happens. Is the ABS something that's around the corner? Because to me, the first baby steps to that are probably implementing better TrackMan usage and tech usage as far as the strike zone goes.
Yep.
And so if that's something that college baseball wants down the line in order to mirror Major League Baseball, which has been, by the way, a widely discussed objective of college right now, is they want there to be a lot of synergy between how the college game is played and how the pro game is played.
Yep.
And to me, the first step to being able to mirror another change is you got to improve the technology. You got to have the umpires more, you know, versed in being able to use it. And if you are, we get to a point a year, 2 years, 3 years down the line in one of these rule changes years where ABS becomes a thing and college baseball players are able to start taking advantage of that. And to me, that is an area where the training aspect comes in. A better and more versed ABS player is going to become something that matters. Definitely, yep, on the margins. But a player who's able to use that effectively and doesn't waste those opportunities, to me, gains an advantage from a skill set. Like, that's a tool to me.
Right. And I think
you get somebody who understands that.
Yeah. And as you're talking this through as well, like, increasingly major league teams are using college baseball as their player development group. Like, so many players are going to college baseball and you're sort of offloading the player dev to the college game. If you are now putting those players in the exact same sort of strike zone system that they're going to find at the minor league level, if the biggest benefit is like there is a less steep learning curve in pro ball, that's still a benefit. If you're used to the zone and then there's a consistency and you don't have this huge adjustment period that's purely strike zone oriented, I think that's a good thing. I generally like the ABS challenge system as well. If down the line, the tech is in a position where conferences or teams or college baseball as a whole can decide to do that, I think that is just positive for the game. And I know that's maybe more of a hot button topic that we don't really have to address now, but in general, all this news is positive for me. And if the bar for you is that we need a perfect zone, you're not going to get that no matter what system you're using ever. And you're always going to be disappointed. So I think the rules in place today are better than they were yesterday. And that's a good thing for the sport. It's good for the players. It seems good all around to me.
I'll say one more thing on this. You know, one sentiment that I heard pretty widely from Division I college baseball coaches, at least, is that the technology is out there, so why not use it, kind of a situation. Mm-hmm. And to have not had that in place before, to them and to me, I would agree, felt like a waste. Like, you might as well use it if you have it. And so this is one of those situations where I'm not sure, and you said this earlier, and I just agree with it, that this can be a bad thing. I don't know how, right, you could look at this and find a negative in it. I see only positives from this change. One change that could be coming as well, and this is going to be sent out to Division I coaches via survey, is how to deal with two issues relating to scoring. One of them is, once baseball games at the college level go into extras, do college baseball teams start putting a runner at second? The proposition is going to be, do we put a runner at second in the 10th, or do we put a runner at second in the 12th in order to shorten ball games? And especially now that's coming into focus with teams being shortened, 34-man rosters are coming into play in about 2-3 years from now. We'll actually see teams at 34 players. Of course, right now, that's not realistic because there's a system to have over that 34-man cap to not take away opportunities from players who already had them. But as rosters do get shorter over time, games, they're going to want to be shorter. The other way that they're talking about doing that is implementing an automatic 12-run mercy rule. Right now, the agreement is 10 runs after 7 innings and only if it's agreed upon at the handshake at home plate before the game starts. So Coach A has to say to Coach B, are you okay with a mercy rule after the 7th inning? Coach B has to agree. They have to tell the umpires that, and only then is it implemented. Some conferences are choosing to use that in their games, but that's a conference decision right now. Mm-hmm. This would be an NCAA mandated run rule where 12 runs after 7 innings would be the end of the ball game. What are your thoughts on doing that? For me personally, mirror the pro game. Let's just do it. You know, the run rule to me is a great amateur tool. The extra inning runner is something that's happening at the professional level. And if you're going to be the premier development area for professional baseball, you should be mirroring the game overall.
Yeah, I'm torn on this one. The slaughter rule, the run rule, I'm all on board, all for it. I think even 10 runs would be fine. But you know, it's tricky for me because in the minor leagues, I'm all for the extra inning runner rule whenever you want to do it, because ultimately, like, no one really cares about the wins and beyond, like, the team. Obviously, the team and the players, they want to win, but like the executives, the people assembling the teams, the scouts, like, the goal is not for you to win baseball games in the minor leagues. It's for you to become a better baseball player and to progress to the major leagues. And once you get to the major leagues, winning is important, and that's what matters. And at the major league level, I don't like the run rule because I think it's just kind of artificial and it doesn't feel like real baseball. And I feel like at this stage, like, you got to go win the game. And so I value the wins and losses more at the college baseball level than I do at the minor league level. And I could see an argument that, like, it's just such a change to what baseball is. I generally am not a fan of it. I would be okay with it because the argument that you could make is like, okay, we need to worry about player health if we have limited pitching staffs and those are being shortened. Like, that makes sense to me. You don't want to regularly be going into extra inning games that aren't like that, you're not finishing and you're really wearing down arms. Like, that all makes sense to me. I don't love it. I'd be fine with it. It's not going to like change the game too much for me. And like, personally, I'll be getting out of ballparks a lot sooner when these extra inning get, but you also like don't have those epic extra inning games that become classics, and there is something to losing that. So for the mercy rule, I'm all for it. I think it's great. For the extra runner and extra innings, I'm more torn. I'm not sure if you have like a clear lean one way or the other. I do appreciate the, like, if the goal is to sync up college and the pro game, just kind of mirror the rules there. That makes sense. But at the same time, if you think that Major League Baseball is implementing rules that are just kind of dumb, you don't want to like lock yourself into those rules when you don't have to. So what do you think? In particular, I'm curious what you think about the extra inning runner, because that one really just, it kills me for whatever reason.
Yeah, I mean, let's get the run rule, the slaughter rule out of the way first. All for it. If it's a 12-run game after the seventh inning, we don't have
an agreement
anymore.
There. Yeah,
we've seen enough. Yeah. I'm kind of in a difference of head and heart situation as it relates to the extra inning runner. And I think that the
that's a good way to describe it. I think I'm with
says I'm with you on the heart part, where I yearn for the extra inning game that is a back and forth affair, and you know, there's the classic hit that wins it, or you know, the big play that saves the game, and you don't have that runner on second base. And like you said, I think there's an artificial element to putting a runner out there and giving a team an opportunity to score with somebody who didn't get on base. And I don't like that. And I've never liked it. I don't like it at the major league level. I wouldn't like it at the college level. The head part of me says that if Major League Baseball is going to do it, whether I like it or not, and that's the important distinction. And I think that this is what a lot of coaches will vote as well. Whether I like it or not, it exists. And if college baseball is going to be this increasingly important developmental area, and it is, even let's say that the draft stays at 20 rounds, the minor leagues don't shrink, neither of which I expect to actually happen, college baseball is still an increasingly popular place to develop players and for major league teams to go get those guys. Do I want a pitcher who's used to dealing with a situation in the 10th inning where there's a runner on second to start the inning and he has to get out of the frame without giving a run up because that's what he's going to have to do as a professional? Yeah, that's the guy that I would want. I want the guy who is adequately prepared to deal with the situation that he's going to be facing as a professional. I don't like it. I think that it is artificial, but I think that broadly speaking, and it doesn't just apply to the extra inning runner rule, college baseball should mirror professional baseball as much as possible. I think the same thing, if you ask me, you know, should college baseball have wood bats? Yeah.
I was about to say the one rule that if you're going to mirror, wood bats would be tremendous. And I would much rather have that than this extra inning rule. And I also say too, I would be much more pro extra inning runner if it was stipulated, like regular season games, we're using it. Postseason, conference tournament, NCAA tournament, we're not using it. I don't know if there's been any language or discussion on that yet, but Major League Baseball is using this capacity as well. In games that matter, I want no part of it. And maybe you can make a case of like, well, all the games really matter, but it makes it even more painful when it is a postseason playoff tournament game, I think.
Well, and there was, so first of all, there was no distinction on that. It's way too early. Just to reiterate, so everybody understands the process for this right now, because it's not a rules year, so it can't change at this exact moment in time. Division I coaches will or already have received a survey in which they'll be asked Do you want a runner on second to begin extras? If you do, would you want it in the 10th or the 12th? Should we have this 12-1 run mercy rule? And then the coaches will vote. Those votes will go back to this Division I oversight committee. They will have a discussion. If the majority of the votes are in favor of these things, my expectation is that it'll move quickly. 2027 is a rules year for college baseball. If coaches are in favor of this, I bet we see it as soon as then. I don't think it's going to take two rule cycles to get there. But because it's still so early, I don't know exactly what their vision is in terms of postseason, have it or not. Broadly speaking, though, I would reiterate this. If it's going to exist in the professional level, it should exist in college. I think that's the case with wood bats. I think it's exists with the extra innings. I think it's the case with the double first base. You know, I was actually talking to a couple college coaches, and then I'll let you say what you're going to say. The double first base was something that's faced a ton of opposition behind the scenes before it got put in. It's great. 100%. Are there things that need to be smoothed over with it? Yes, there are. I specifically, and this was discussed at ABCA, how an errant throw is determined in terms of which bag the runner touches is still something that needs to be ironed out. There are a lot of coaches right now who are teaching you touch the colored bag no matter what. Errant throw, you know, drop third strike, you touch the colored bag, and then you run back when you're returning and you touch the white. That's what you do. Still needs to be ironed out. But coaches love it now. It's something that makes a lot of sense. I would like to see it at the major league level. I don't think it makes a material difference to the game. It doesn't feel artificial to me. I would have that exist throughout baseball, period.
Right.
The extra runner does feel artificial. It's forced. I don't like it. But again, I am of the mindset, not of the heart, that if it's going to exist at the top, it needs to exist everywhere.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I just agree with you. The first base, the double bag, purely is like an aesthetic. Like people didn't like the way it looked. It looked weird. They associated it with softball. They're like, this isn't baseball. But outside of those like random cases you're talking about, where to me it should be like the runner runs through the running bag and you throw to the regular bag regardless of the play. Like the previous situation was worse because you're both still heading for one base. It seems to me like it could be consistent, but I think that's generally just positive across the board. People get used to it looking a little bit odd and funky, but it doesn't change the actual on-field product or the game. What I was going to ask though is like in your conversation, I don't know how many conversations you've had about this specifically with coaches, but like, would your sense be that most college coaches are for the extra inning runner? Would you expect for most of them to vote for that? Just because, like you said, most of them seem to also want to align with the major league game.
So I would for that reason. The one thing that I would say garnered a pretty decent amount of support in the conversations that occurred after the presentation was given was this option for the 12th inning. And I like that actually as well. That would mean that the 10th and the 11th are played as normal. There's no runner on second base. You get to the 12th inning, you put a runner out there, we shorten the game down because we don't need 12, 13, 14, 15 innings. I want that to, you know, don't put that in the postseason. Give me regular, you know, good old fashioned baseball in the postseason. But in the regular season at the college level where these arms are underdeveloped and there's just no reason to put that kind of stress on guys that don't need to face it. Yeah, I think that a lot of coaches are for that. And the 12th inning kind of presents this best of both worlds situation where it's like, we're going to shorten the rosters. You're going to have less pitching depth. You don't want to play these super long games early on in the season. Yeah. You get to the 12th inning, we're going to get on with it and kind of make it easier to win or lose the game. But it still, you know, keeps the integrity of extra innings in the 10th and the 11th. I think
that seems like a fair compromise.
Right. And the 10th inning is where you kind of get into this artificial territory. I do think that there's going to be coaches who do it just to mirror the pros. Like I really believe that this, you know, head versus heart, I go back to that. I think that that's kind of something that a lot of people are weighing, whether they describe it that way or not. That's kind of the sticking point for a lot of people is that they don't want a difference between college baseball and Major League Baseball. And so I think that ultimately we'll end up seeing it just right away in the 10th. But I personally really like the idea of the 12th inning, and I know a lot of coaches do too.
Yeah, same.
Every day, companies you've probably never heard of are making billions off your personal data. Your name, address, phone number, even details about your family are pulled from public records in the internet and then sold without your consent. There's an entire marketplace making money off of your privacy, and most people have no idea it exists. Aura's online security capabilities have allowed me to feel safe when it comes to my online presence. Aura fights back. They remove your personal data from broker sites and keep it off. Aura also alerts you fast if your information shows up in a breach or on the dark web. But Aura is more than just a data broker removal. It is a full digital security suite that protects every part of your life online. Aura gives you a VPN to stay private, antivirus to block threats, a password manager to keep logins safe, and spam call protection to cut off scammers. Aura also scans the dark web for your most sensitive information, like your social security number, bank logins, and passwords, and notifies you instantly if they're exposed. Aura also removes what is already exposed, protects what's not, and puts you back in control. Right now, you can try Aura free for 14 days when you visit aura.com/remove. That's enough time for Aura to start removing your personal information from data broker sites. Sign up today at aura.com/remove and get the peace of mind that your privacy, identity, and finances are safeguarded. That's aura.com/remove. Certain terms apply. See the site for details. All right. I would be completely remiss to have you on the podcast and not talk about some draft stuff. Rock Chalowski obviously is our top prospect, as he is pretty much everywhere throughout the industry right now.
Notably good baseball player. Yeah.
Yeah. He's solid. And he plays for a solid team at UCLA, which, as we've already talked about on a previous podcast, will be our preseason number one. There's no more secret there anymore. Rock Chalowski is at the front of that. My question to you is, where does this stack up historically among college players? It feels increasingly rare that we have a position player, especially in the college ranks, who is this definitively stuck at the top of the draft board like Rock Chalowski is. And yeah. In your experience, I guess, you know, compare for me what this is like against like the Alex Bregman, Dansby Swanson, Adley Rutschman conversations that existed in their respective years as well.
Yeah, we've kind of lumped the Dansby Swanson, Alex Bregman conversation with Rock, because I do think he's the best college shortstop prospect since those two. That whole draft cycle was before my time at BA. And I'd say the first like no-brainer, wire-to-wire number one prospect that I covered was Adley Rutschman in 2019. And so ahead of this podcast, I went back and I just pulled up, okay, who are all of our college top-ranked players from that 2019 class to now? And who maybe belongs in that conversation, and which of these players does Rock belong with? Because I think you can make a case that he is the most like no-brainer consensus top prospect since Adley Rutschman. There's one other player I want to bring up to see what you think. But so in 2019, we had Adley Rutschman ranked number one. Every ranking we ever put out for that cycle starting the summer prior to his draft year, he was number one, didn't move out of that spot. In 2020, that was the COVID year, we had Spencer Torkelson number one in the preseason. We did shuffle that in season, him and Austin Martin throughout the year. So I think even at the time, Rock clears sort of the status that Spencer Torkelson had in that class. In 2021, we had Kamar Rocker as the number one player at the top. I remember that year specifically, it was very tricky to figure out who we were going to rank at the top. That class lacked a lot of consensus at the top, and Kamar didn't wind up being our number one ranked prospect. That was Jordan Lawler, a high school shortstop out of Texas. In 2022, we didn't have a college player ranked number one in the class. We had Brooks Lee, who ranked number three on the preseason. He stuck in that range throughout the year. I think he finished number two behind Drew Jones, and we had Jackson Holliday number three behind him. Skip over number 2023 for a second, but 2024, we had JJ Weatherholt was in the number one spot at the same time. Our preseason list number one. The prior summer, Nick Kurtz and him were kind of jockeying back and forth for number one. Then both of them dealt with some injuries during their draft year and were passed up by Charlie Condon and Travis Bazana. So I think Rock is at this stage ahead of all those players in terms of no doubt consensus status in the class in favor to be the number one overall pick. The one player I want to throw at you, though, is Dylan Cruz. At least at this stage, Dylan Cruz in the 2023 class was our consensus top player. There was not a ton of debate. It was a good class at the top. There were two high school players in Walker Jenkins and Max Clark who had compelling cases, and other draft years, they would have been really good number one prospects. But on our preseason list, Dylan Cruz was in the number one spot. At the time, his college competition was actually Chase Dolander, who came into the year. Maybe people probably forget about it now because of how good Paul Skeens has been and what he did that draft year. But before the season started, Chase Dolander was like the consensus top arm. So we still had Dylan Cruz ranked number one throughout the circuit. So at this stage, it's just Adley and just Dylan Cruz who were in those number one spots the entire draft cycle. Rock's got a chance to join them. And I think I would probably put Rock above Dylan Cruz at this stage now, just because the positional element seems to be a bigger factor. But Dylan Cruz, like, I don't want to forget how good he was viewed at the time. He had pluses across the board. He hit the ball exceptionally hard. He played a premium position. He had a tremendous SEC production. He had plus tools across the board. I think the speed is maybe the one area you could say he had a better tool than Rock does now with his speed. So I don't think people should sleep on Dylan Cruz, even if they want to say Rock is in like a different tier, maybe because of the shortstop factor, because of what he did as a sophomore. But those are the three names for me. I'm curious, like, where your sense of where he might stack up with those guys is.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I was doing kind of a similar look back, and Dylan Cruz was the one who stood out as like, maybe this is the one that we're not talking about enough, because we were looking at Adley. And I think that comparison makes a lot of sense. The wire to wire number one prospect types. Cruz definitely is in the same conversation. I think Rock takes the cake for me for two primary reasons. The first is the sophomore success. We have never had somebody win back-to-back Player of the Year awards. I would say going into the season that I feel reasonably confident that Rock is going to be in the conversation. Does that mean he's going to win it? Not necessarily, but do I think he's one of three guys who I would pinpoint as the front runners, the easiest picks for Player of the Year at the end of the year? Easily so. I think that Drew Burris is in that conversation. And then I think that you're looking at guys like Sawyer Strohsnyder is the sneaky one to me. Yeah. I think that if he has a really great year at TCU, we're going to be talking about whether or not he's Player of the Year. And I think that there is at least a reasonable conversation to be had about how high in the draft he can go. He plays center field. He's athletic. There are more hit tool questions with him than we have with Rock, but it's really good power. I think it's a really well-rounded skill set, and he's toolsy. So like Strohsnyder to me is the challenger going into this year. The second thing is that I do think that in the Cruz year, there were other prospects who emerged really quickly as challengers for number one. That would be Skeens, of course, and Wyatt Langford at Florida was the other one who really made a push throughout that season to go 1-1 and kind of challenge the narrative that Dylan Cruz was the best available player in that draft. I don't think, even with the guys who I just named, Burris, Strohsnyder, AJ Gracia maybe is in that conversation.
I'll throw Justin LeBron in there as well.
Yeah, maybe Justin LeBron. Yep. I don't think that those guys are in the same tier as what Rock is in going into the year. And that is, of course, something that only exists like draft class by draft class. You know, Rock Chalowski has nothing to do with the fact that there aren't other players who are going to push him for 1-1, at least on the college side. That being said, I also don't think anybody's going to get close. Like, Wyatt Langford really did a lot to make up ground. Paul Skeens had the best year, you know, since Steven Strasburg played college baseball by a college pitcher. It's one of the best seasons ever by a college player, regardless of position. If you ask scouts right now or analysts about Justin LeBron, I guarantee you if I ask 10 people, I can get negative feedback on him. There are people out there who do not think that Justin LeBron is the best position player in this class or even top five. I have feedback from multiple people who would say that. I think that there are, like I said about Sawyer Strohsnyder, there are real questions about the hit tool, even with the statistical production he had as a freshman last year. You look at AJ Gracia, there are questions there. Caden Bogenpohl was a really hot name going into this year at the end of last season, and we've moved him down rather considerably in our draft rankings because there has been negative feedback. I have not yet had a conversation with somebody about Rock Chalowski in which I came away saying there's a little bit of doubt there. You know, this evaluator sees X problem with Rock Chalowski. It is universally excellent feedback. And so I think the difference for me between Cruz's year and Cruz himself and Rock's year and Rock himself is that I just don't see a legitimate contender to push him. Like I think that he's so far clear of everybody else that it makes him unique. And that's where I go back to 2019 with Adley Rutschman and say, I just don't think that there's going to be a change. I think it's going to be a wire to wire, one to one.
Yeah, it could be. And I mean, that's why the season getting started, we can't wait for it to happen because all these players behind them are going to have opportunities to improve their draft stock. Rock himself, if he struggles, which I wouldn't expect, and I don't think anyone expects, just given the way he's talked about and just the quality of him as a player, like No one expects that, but it's possible. We never really know what's going to happen prior to the season. I don't think anyone would have assumed that Paul Skeens was going to add 3 miles to his fastball, develop his banger breaking ball, and become one of the best pitching prospects we've ever seen. So
look at Jace LaValette from last year. Sorry to interrupt you.
But, right,
but
yeah,
like, exactly. With the conversation that we were having about LaValette going into the 2025 season and then what ended up happening were two vastly different things.
Right.
I mean, he did not live up to the expectations that existed. And I think going into the year, we can easily say that he was one of the better, more highly regarded prospects, at least in the post-COVID world. He was in that. It felt like, at least to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it felt like he was in this elite 1-1 tier going into the year. And then he hit below 300 and we saw right. a lot of the problems that existed and he fell down the board.
Yeah, I don't know if Jace was quite at this tier just because he always did have those sort of contact questions. But in terms of like the secondary tools and the athlete, like he was an outlier sort of physicality, and the SEC production that he had for multiple years was sort of a separator. And then, as you mentioned, he kind of came out of the gate slow, didn't have a great season. But I'll just point out one more time, like Dylan Cruz in his 3-year career with LSU, he didn't have an OPS under 1116. That's 3 years with an OPS north of 1100. Rock Chulowski, for as great as he is, he had an 899 OPS his freshman year. So just the track record of offensive performance in college was exceptional for Dylan Cruz. And I'm hopeful that Rock Chulowski can kind of continue to improve as a player overall. Because, I mean, he made great adjustments in terms of his approach, in terms of getting the ball in the air and hitting for power. But Dylan Cruz never hit less than 18 home runs in a single season, 3 years, 18 plus. Rock jumped from 8 to 23. So I think there is maybe even a difference in sort of the collegiate track record of these players. And I do think people maybe sleep on a little bit just how well-regarded Dylan Cruz was at the time because he hasn't quite panned out and become the player we expected him to be. But to go back to everything you said, Rock Chulowski is in a tier of his own right now in this draft class. There's not a player that I would put in the same tier as him on our board right now. I guess we'll see what happens in the season.
For sure. And just one more thing on Rock, I would say, you know, I think people forget how steep the curve has been for Rock. Like you mentioned the freshman season stats, that was a rough year for UCLA overall in 2024. They were bad. Mm-hmm. And Rock was a part of that group. It was a very freshman heavy class. Mulevalevu was on that team and wasn't necessarily a great player. Dean West was on that team and wasn't a great player. You can go up and down the projected lineup for UCLA right now. And every single one of those guys who's now going to start for a team that's expected to win it all, we're not very good just years ago, but Rock, more than anybody in the country, obviously, you know, took this massive step up between freshman and sophomore season. So the path to where he's at, I think, is different than Dylan Cruz. And if you want to look at the holistic college picture, I think there's an argument to be made that Dylan Cruz is one of the best players that we've seen in the last decade, just from a pure college standpoint. Like put the draft aside for a second. Pure college production, really hard to match what Dylan Cruz did. But from a you combine the conversation, it's like draft and college. I think what Rock did last year and has a chance to do this year could really separate him and kind of put him in this historic category, especially if he's going to hold on to the, you know, player of the year conversation and be there at the end of the year. Because like I said, nobody has done that before. He has a chance to be one of one as far as the college conversation goes.
Seeing him do back-to-back Baseball America College Player of the Year would be exceptional. It'd be crazy. We might never see that again.
There are only six people who have ever won it as a non-draft eligible player. Rock was the sixth. So he's already in this super rare, extremely talented group. And by the way, you look at the players who have done that, they've all gone
pretty
on
good track
to have,
record.
Yeah, exactly. Tremendous success. Yeah. So he's already kind of breathing rare air. And now it's just a matter of, does he separate himself from that already very small 1% group? There's a really great chance that he does. And you know, this is going to come as a surprise to anybody. I'm not spoiling secrets here. Like, this will be our preseason player of the year is Rock Chulowski. We are projecting him to become the first player of the year back-to-back seasons. We're not going to shy from that now. And you'll see it over at baseballamerica.com in the next couple of weeks. Los, the last thing I want to talk to you about, early season things to watch for. We're talking about, you know, Sawyer Strohsnyder and Justin LeBron and all these guys who are not necessarily playing catch up, because I think it's a race that's kind of already won. But we are talking about who is going to finish second, who puts themselves in this top five conversation for the draft against some of these really good high school players. What are the keys to getting off on the right foot and avoiding, just to call back to an example we just gave, the Jace LaValette 2025 track where you kind of start off on the wrong foot and don't really recover? What do you have to do?
Yeah, I mean, across the board for everyone, you've got to go out and perform. At the end of the day, the numbers need to be good. You need to put up solid production. But I think as you're watching pitchers and hitters in college baseball early in the year, it is a lot easier to react early to changes that pitchers have made. I'm going to be really curious to see like just what arsenals look like. Are pitchers throwing harder? Are they throwing slower? Have they added new breaking balls? Those are the things that are going to show up immediately. First start, once we're watching guys like Liam Peterson, Cameron Flukey, just seeing what those arsenals look like from day one should give us a pretty good picture of like, has something substantive changed? Like a lot of these guys have worked on things in the offseason, whether that's mechanically, whether that's from a pitch mix perspective, whether that's from just intent and what they're looking like trying to do on the mound in terms of like where the ball is actually going. All that should show up pretty quickly. For hitters, you need to be a little bit more patient. Most of these schools, most of the players at the top of our board, they're going to be in pretty favorable matchups early in the season. The non-conference games they're playing, you would expect them to put up big numbers. So don't let the early season performance wow you. And for hitters in particular, I'm looking for like, do the bodies look different? Have players gotten bigger and stronger? Does the swing look any different than it did in the past? Have players cleaned things up? Is their approach more improved? There are hitters in the class that have swing and miss tendencies. Like, are there mechanical or approach changes that we can see right away that maybe would indicate some improvement or regression in those areas? And then for the defense and the overall season production, you just need a little bit longer to kind of feel like any changes are sticky or just get the sort of playing time and reps needed to have a strong takeaway. So I'd say in general, all these players, you want them to perform. Obviously for pitchers, arsenal changes can be quicker to ID. And then for hitters, we're looking at tools, we're looking at setup. And once we get into conference play, then we can start to maybe drill down and say, okay, who's really not performing. And then we can start to say like, okay, these numbers that are really loud, are we doing it against like quality competition as well? So that's kind of a lot to throw at you, but that's what I'm generally looking at. And also just, are we getting positive or negative feedback from the scouting community?
There you go. We head on over to baseballamerica.com to check out all of our content as it relates to some of these early season findings. There's going to be a ton of things that go up on the site between now and February 13th, which is college baseball opening day. Baseballamerica.com/college is where you're going to find all of our college-related content specifically. One other thing that you should be aware of, Carlos and I are going to be doing the draft podcast now, as many of you have seen. My previous and Carlos' previous co-host, Peter Flaherty, is on to professional baseball. He is now a scout with the Washington Nationals, so we're rooting for Pete over on the pro side. But until we get things ironed out on the Baseball America staff, it's the two of us. We're going to be helping each other out quite a bit. And also, things to look forward to. We're going to have quite a few guests on the college podcast starting next week. I'm not going to spoil who that's going to be yet, mostly because I'm worried about scheduling and whether or not people are going to flake. But if they don't flake, we have really cool guests lined up for the next couple of weeks to get us ready for the college baseball season. So stay tuned. We're coming out weekly every Monday now, and that'll be our routine throughout the college season to discuss top 25 and things like that once things really get going. So again, baseballamerica.com/college. Check us out on the college, on the draft podcast and the college podcast. It'll be the two of us for the next couple of weeks here at least. And then again, look forward to some guests on the college side as we get closer and closer to the college season. For this episode, though, that's going to do it. For Carlos Collazo, I'm Jacob Rudner, and we will see you next time.